Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have three guests, Emily Dickinson, Robert Frost, and Wallace Stevens, here in spirit. We're just going to go through a few poems of theirs. They're all winter poems, now that we're coming out of this cold spell. Let's look back. The first one is called There's a Certain Slant of Light. It's Emily Dickinson's poem. She didn't title her poems. The titles are taken from the first line of her poems, and they're given a number in how they were arranged by her. When she died in 1885, her family went through her things upstairs, and they were shocked, surprised, to find these boxes filled with sheets of paper with poems on them. They knew she wrote poems earlier in her life, but a lot of people wrote poems. They write poems on Christmas cards. Verse was a much more popular activity by many, many people than it is today. But when they went upstairs after she had passed away of Bright's disease in her 55th year, they found these little shoebox size boxes filled with more than 1,700 poems. And they were astounded by them. It took them a few years to get them all together. And with the help of Thomas Wentworth Higginson, an editor, put them together into a volume that was published. It was an instant sensation when it was published in 1890 for the first time, went through five editions in a couple of years, made Emily Dickinson one of the most famous women in America by the turn of the century. Everyone was wondering, who was this person? Well, here's one of the reasons why people are still compelled by her. There's a certain slant of light. There's a certain slant of light, winter afternoons, that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes. Heavenly hurt it gives us, we can find no scar, but internal difference where the meanings are. None may teach it any, 'tis the sealed despair. An imperial affliction sent us of the air. When it comes, the landscape listens, shadows hold their breath. When it goes, 'tis like the distance on the look of death. We have there four stanzas, and you can hear the Emily Dickinson style very easily. She's one of those poets whom you read three lines, you don't even know, you don't even have to know the title or the author, you know it's hers. She has a signature. Let's go through it slowly. You've got these four-line stanzas written in what's called hymn meter. You've got roughly an ABCB rhyme scheme. You've got four feet, three feet, roughly each stanza. There's a certain slant of light, winter afternoons. Those are the first two lines. And you have that Dickinson dash in there. Now, one of the things you have to do in order to understand a poem is first exercise not your analytical powers, but your imagination. You have to imagine the situation, imagine the scene. We're in winter, afternoon, it's 3 o'clock. Somehow there's a slant of light. The sun is low in the sky. And we know that Emily Dickinson was a resident of Massachusetts, Amherst. And we don't mean Florida winter afternoons here. We're talking about up high in the hemisphere where the sun never really gets too bright often during the day. I spent a winter up there once, and it seemed that for about 3 months the sky was just a pale white, and the sun passed by as just sort of a dim bulb in the sky. It wasn't dark, but it wasn't bright either. Think of that in terms of where Emily Dickinson is there in Western Massachusetts. She was largely a recluse by roughly her mid-20s. When she was in her late teens, she did go to Mount Holyoke Seminary. It wasn't a college at that point, seminary for girls. She spent a year there and enjoyed the intellectual activity. This is obviously a brilliant woman. She watched as the Second Great Awakening was passing through New England at this time and marveled at the genuine transformation of the other girls in the school. She didn't join in herself, but she appreciated the revival of faith. But then she had to leave after a year. She went back home to her family, pretty much stayed in the house for the rest of her life, became known as this odd figure. They could see her light, her candle on in her bedroom window. But she didn't venture much beyond the property for most of the time. Occasional walks with her dog, Carlo. So imagine her in the front yard, 3 o'clock. It's February, January. And the light has a certain slant, and something about it compels her. It's a vague phrase. There's a certain slant of light. And that's a funny word to use, a slant about it. Again, the sun low in the sky. We have some nice musical sounds there. Certain slant. Winter, again, to part of the music of the verse. It's important to pick up the sound and the repetitions. Winter afternoons, that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes. There's something oppressive, something gray, heavy. We have a heft in this light. The cathedral tunes, walking into the large church and hearing the sounds from the organ. You feel the pressure. That's the metaphor, the simile that she uses here. Heavenly hurt it gives us. This is the next stanza. It's a heavenly hurt. We feel some kind of pain, but the source is from up above. This isn't an ordinary human pain. It doesn't come out of any secular experience. We can find no scar, nothing that attacks us, but internal difference where the meanings are. We feel something spiritual happen within, something oppressive, a hurt, a heaviness, some kind of pressure that affects us inside, internal difference. And that's where the meanings are, as she puts it. Not the feelings. She says, what does it mean? And this lifts you up into something a little metaphysical. We've got this physical phenomenon of the low light, the sun going down in winter, but there's something more than that. The effect it has upon us is cosmic, something bigger than ordinary experience. Third stanza, none may teach it any. That any there is set off by dashes with a capital A. I'm actually not sure how to place that any syntactically. None may teach it anything. None may teach anything about it. It being this heavenly hurt, this internal difference caused by this moment on winter afternoons. But the point being, this is not a knowledge that can be passed along from one person to another. There are no teachers here for this, and it doesn't even have a specific content. It has only an affect. 'Tis the seal, despair. That's the oppression. Despair, something about the absence of hope one feels at this moment. An imperial affliction, sort of an echo of heavenly hurt. It's an imperial affliction sent us of the air. It comes through the atmosphere. It's in the air around us. And it's sent to us. We receive it from some metaphysical, some cosmic, some divine source. And we shift the verb, sent us of the air, and then it comes back. When it comes, the landscape listens. This slant of light hits the landscape, and there seems to be a pause. Everything gets quiet and stops. The whole landscape is receiving this message. The landscape listens. Shadows hold their breath. Not people hold their breath. Shadows, even the shadows are affected by this slant of light. When it goes, it's a nice syntactical parallel. When it comes, third line, when it goes. When it goes, 'tis like the distance on the look of death. And many times you read an Emily Dickinson line and you wonder, what exactly does that refer to? The distance. Nice rhyme. Listens, distance, breath, death. That last stanza is A-B-A-B. Rhyme makes it very tight. 'Tis like the distance on the look of death. You try to tie that to some ordinary phenomenon. For example, when you are at a funeral and you look at the corpse, there is death, and that person is gone, far away. That's the distance that we see here, the look of death. But again, it's just like the distance on the look of death. Okay? Something is passing here, and when the light goes and we enter into the darkness of the winter evening, we feel like death has passed through the landscape and through us as well. So there's Emily Dickinson. I often make students memorize her poems. I tell them they can bring them out at dinner parties. Cheer everyone up. The next one everyone has heard of, by probably the most famous poet in American literary history, Robert Frost. And this is one you hear quoted many, many times, and so I thought I would do a little bit of breakdown of this piece, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep and miles to go before I sleep. Now, everyone has heard of that poem. They've heard it recited many times. Frost himself recited it. I was in an office a few years ago of Jeff Nelson, who's at the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, and he has a picture on the wall. It's a photograph from the late 1950s. One of those wide-angle photographs. It looks like it covers almost 300 degrees, and it's of a basketball arena. And it shows all the stands in this arena filled. And the image is crisp enough where you can make out individual faces. You can see what people are wearing. And they're all young people. And they look like students, college students. And the caption actually shows Wayne State University, the late 50s, 58 or 59. The basketball court, the floor has been cleared. The baskets have been removed, the lower stands have been pushed back, and you've got an open space with just a podium in the center. And there is one white-haired man standing there, and it's Robert Frost reading a poem. You must have 10, 11,000 people in the stands. That tells you something about the power of Robert Frost and the power of American poetry, what poetry meant in mid-20th century America. That you could get thousands and thousands of college students to come out and listen to some 80-year-old man reading his verse. This poem is one reason why it affects people. The first lines, whose woods these are, I think I know. It's a sentence by itself. Eight words, very simple, all monosyllables. And when you read the two, it sounds almost like a child talking. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. Okay. It's a simple fact. Seems unimportant. I mean, why are you talking about who owns this little piece of land? He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. You stop in the road, you look at someone's property. If someone who owns the property is standing there, the person looks and he says, "What do you want?" Okay. But here he's free. The guy's not there. And that Frost can stop. And here, use your imagination to imagine the scene. It's winter. Frost is going home in his carriage. stops on the roadside. There's nothing there. It's just some woods. And the snow is coming down. So it's a pause there. So I try to visualize Frost pulling up on the reins and turning and looking off to the side. There is a hint as well that there might be something wrong or a little embarrassing about him doing this. That's why he says, he will not see me stopping here. I can do this. No one is going to pay attention. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near. Well, of course, that doesn't make sense. The horse is a domesticated animal. It's a creature of habit. It does its jobs, and then it goes back to its stall. Why are we stopping here? This doesn't make sense. Between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. Deep in winter. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if summer's there, some mistake. Come on, let's go. Again, you're breaking up the routine. Labor must be done. Okay. Habits must be followed. And the irony here is the horse becomes a mild rebuke. There's some mistake going on here. Why are you staring off into these woods? You've got something else to do. So he hears the horse shake his bells, and then he says, the only other sound's the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. That description there, with the adjectives easy and downy, suggests something mesmerizing about this scene. And if you've seen snow lightly coming down, it can be hypnotic. The flakes are steady. They sort of waver back and forth. They fall to the ground. They're quiet. You know, they say there's a sound. Can't be very much. It's easy. It's soft. And there's something compelling there for Frost. How nice it would be to stop and just relax and let yourself be carried away by this hypnotic scene. Last stanza. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep. The word lovely. See, that's the attraction. Dark and deep. The darkness and the depth of it is one of the most compelling things about the woods. But I have promises to keep. And miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. That's one of those poetic decisions in the process of composition, to repeat the third line again as the fourth line. And you can see how he sets up the powerful effect of that repetition with the rhyme scheme preceding it. Whose woods of the are, think I know, his house is in the village though. A. He will not see me stopping here, B, to watch his woods fill up with snow, A. So it's A. But in the next stanza, the B of the preceding stanza becomes the A. Stopping here turns into, my little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. Lake then is then carried over to, gives his harness bells a shake, some mistake. The only other sound's the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. And then we get to deep, promises to keep. And then the miles to go before I sleep. That sound repeating once again. The repetition of it shows the insistence of the necessity of going on. You've got things to do. People may be waiting for you at home. Yes. It would be nice to stop, to rest, to relax, to die sometimes. But no, you've got miles to go yet. Your home is a few miles away, and it's time to move on. All right. The last one is by this insurance executive named Wallace Stevens. He wrote poems in his spare time. He was a lawyer and a vice president for the Hartford Insurance Company. He lived in Hartford most of the second half of his life. And here you have another vision of the Connecticut winter. When he did write these poems, he didn't talk about it at the office. You know, he really had a separate life, divided them completely. Once one of his co-workers, late in his life, I think it was the late 40s, was at a party in New York, and a critic was there, Alan Tate, I think it was, who heard from the man say, "Yeah, I work for the Hartford Insurance Company." He says, "Oh, you've got one of the great poets in America up there, Wallace Stevens." I think the man said, "Wally?" So here we have the snowman. "One must have a mind of winter to regard the frost in the boughs of the pine trees crusted with snow, and have been cold a long time to behold the junipers shagged with ice, the spruces rough in the distant glitter of the January sun, and not to think of any misery in the sound of the wind, in the sound of a few leaves, which is the sound of the land full of the same wind that is blowing in the same bare place, for the listener who listens in the snow, and nothing himself beholds nothing that is not there, and the nothing that is." That was published in 1921. It's one sentence long. You have five three-line stanzas put together. And it's a description with a strange kind of judgment at the end. Imagine Frost standing there looking out, and there's someone's built a snowman in the field, in the snow. And Frost begins with the strange metaphor, "One must have a mind of winter, a cold mind, in order to regard the frost in the boughs of the pine trees crusted with snow, and have been cold a long time to behold." Get another, we have to regard, it's the middle of the first stanza, and then the infinitive, "to behold," the middle line of the second stanza. "Have been cold a long time to behold the junipers shagged with ice, the spruces rough in the distant glitter of the January sun. And not to think," here's another infinitive, "but not to think." So you have to have a mind of winter to look at the frost, the snow, the trees, to behold the junipers shagged with ice, spruces, not to think of any misery in the sound of the wind, in the sound of a few leaves. When the wind blows through this bare, desolate, white landscape, don't have an emotional reaction. Don't think of suffering, of emptiness, of human isolation. Don't do what Nietzsche talked about, and that is anthropomorphism. That is when we look upon an objective landscape, when we experience a non-human thing, but we give human attributes to it, or we apply human emotions to something that are really just a projection of ourselves. And we have that impulse because we don't want to live in an alien, cold world. There's a temptation to do so, and that's why Stephen says you have to have a wintry mind, a cold sensibility, in order to resist that impulse to hear misery in the sound of the wind, in the sound of a few leaves, which is the sound of the land full of the same wind that is blowing in the same bare place. This is, extending this into a vision of reality here. And Stevens was fascinated with the relationship between imagination and reality. How can we pare reality down to its essentials when we have inside of us emotional, spiritual needs that we so often find reality doesn't satisfy? This wind blows through the land, the same wind all the time, the same bare place. For the listener who listens in the snow, which could be the snowman, or it could be Stevens. Stevens is a listener registering what he sees. Maybe he sees some parallel between himself and the snowman. For the listener who listens in the snow and nothing himself, beholds nothing that is not there and the nothing that is. In that last stanza, nothing appears three times. And the last time having that definite article, the nothing. And there's something, right? There's something paradoxical to call nothing a the, as if nothing were an object. This is what you would call a condensed statement of nihilism, right? Of nothingness. The feeling that there is nothing out there and nothing inside as well. And the courageous or clear-sighted mind, I should say, is one who admits to himself, I am nothing, and I'm not going to make the world out there into something different from what it is. I'm going to behold nothing that is not there. I'm going to listen to the wind rattle through the leaves, and I'm not going to emotionalize it in any way. I'm not going to spiritualize it in any way. All I'm going to do is look at it and listen to it and be perfectly objective. That's the line, beholds nothing that is not there. But then this final phrase, and the nothing that is. That's where we get the nihilistic perspective, which starts to say there is nothingness everywhere. You can feel the presence of a nothing. It is the contrary of faith or of a spiritual apprehension. God is everywhere. No, nothingness is everywhere. Emptiness is universal. That's the final assertion that we have here. But let me clarify one thing. Stevens, in his last few weeks, converted to Catholicism. There's a little controversy over where and how that happened, but a priest has asserted that he was there. He took Stevens's confession, and he did bring him into the church in his final weeks. So there we are. Three lyrics about winter by three of America's greatest poets. This has been Conversations with Mark Bauerlein, a production of First Things Magazine, a publication devoted to examining religion and public life. Read at firstthings.com or subscribe to get our monthly magazine delivered 10 times a year. Thank you.